3rd marks the anniversary of revered Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani is here. Millions of Iranians and admirers worldwide have marked this day with tributes to this anti-terror icon, who is literally the mastermind behind eradicating Daesh terrorists from Iraq and also in Syria and elsewhere. But his targeted assassination ordered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump ended his life, and Iranians and Iranian officials will never forget that. What he symbolized and what motives were behind this U.S. assassination are two of the angles that we will be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Mahmoud Osman, journalist and political analyst, joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Daniel Yejic, author and researcher who joins us from Barcelona. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mahmoud Osman, I'll start with you. The third year anniversary of the late commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the wounds are still very fresh. And it's almost as if this happened yesterday. The U.S. assassination obviously is something that people will not forget about what has happened. I mean, he was such a grand figure, as some have called him, a hero without borders. What is your impression at this point, 3 years to have passed since that dreadful day?
Condolences again to the nation, to the Ummah, to the Iranian nation, and as well to the free people of the world for the third anniversary of the martyrdom of Hajj Qasem Soleimani and his comrade Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Now, when we speak about these two people, and specifically Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we don't speak about just a person or what that person actually symbolizes. We speak about a school, an ideology. We speak about a wave of resistance that struck from the eastern part of Asia to the western part of Asia to try and help the people of this region, to the natives of this region, to liberate themselves and liberate their lands, their resources, their detainees, and to fight colonialism and imperialism. Hajj Qasem Soleimani, since the early, late 80s, early 90s, has had a very specific role in supporting the national resistance in each of West Asia's countries, specifically speaking, Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and later on Yemen, as well as his work in Afghanistan as well. But specifically in my region, where I come from, where I'm a native in my land, Hajj Qasem Soleimani is a symbol of not only liberation, but also standing with the oppressed people. You don't only call for the liberation of the people, you stand with the oppressed. You stand with them not only morally, but also practically on the ground, meaning you give whatever you can possibly give to help them stand up in the face of this occupation or this aggression. This is exactly what Hajj Qasem Soleimani did, which is why his symbolism, his martyrdom affected not only the people of his region, but it transcended across the borders. It went even across Asia, all over the world. I mean, the trips that I took this past year alone, where people were asking me about Hajj Qasem Soleimani, was magical, from Havana to Moscow to elsewhere. Wherever we go, people would like to know more about his personality, more about how he helped. And when we talk about things that the media usually doesn't show, people are in awe. For example, how he helped his own nation when it was flooded in certain areas of Iran, when he helped and when he was on the front lines in Iraq and in Syria. They had no idea. When we show videos of those events that the mainstream media never shows, they are in awe and in shock, and they fall more in love with this symbolism of of a hero being brought into daylight by his martyrdom, not only by the activities and the support that he gave to the resistance of this region.
Sure. That last point that you made, and aside from that, obviously he's a very humble person to add to that, but that last point is what I'd like to ask you, the last point that Marwaz Juan made, Daniel Yejic, when it comes to the resistance. Iran's leader just days ago said that Haj Qasem Soleimani actually was a force that, after the assassination happened, also it has become very clear that it actually boosted, reinvigorated, and gave additional strength to the resistance in the region. And that says a lot, because it covers, obviously, major groups. Can you tell us in what ways that has happened, if you agree?
Yes. Absolutely agree with what has been said, especially when you think about in terms of the resistance and the symbolism that is embodied by his persona, by the way that he has been received and commemorated publicly across Iran, the region, and internationally. And I think that his martyrdom symbolizes or shows just again the very strength of the resistance in the region, and that it continues to organize and to cooperate throughout Western Asia and beyond against this very internationally and structurally organized terror of colonialism, imperialism, and Zionism. And I think that the reactions to his martyrdom that we've seen internationally in the last 3 years have also shown how important this person was for also unifying, again, the school of thought, the idea, the ideology, and beyond that, the ideas of liberation, of solidarity that are so important, that still continue based on his ideas, based on his ideologies and thoughts, continue to flourish in the region and continue to pose another significant threat to the ongoing colonialism, which I think also then brings us again to the question why he was assassinated. There is this very particular strength about this person that obviously has been identified as a major threat for the foreign forces that have been involved in destabilizing and terrorizing Iran and the region for years and decades now.
When you take a look at the reasoning, I know this has been hashed out in some respects, Marwaz Juan, but we have to go through it because in the little time that we have left, it's worthy to review this if we can. And the Agnes Callamard, the UN Special Rapporteur, said that the U.S. was not justified for the attack. Had not provided sufficient evidence. And the evidence that the U.S. gave was no evidence. It said that he was planning an imminent attack against U.S. interests. I mean, I don't know if you remember when Mike Pompeo, the former U.S. Secretary of State, came out and said that. He was planning an attack, particularly in Iraq, and therefore immediate action had to take place. You know, this just doesn't fly. Why is that aspect of the illegality of this, to say the least, not taken up with the U.S. in an international court of justice or some kind of court or somewhere where, you know, the U.S. should be found guilty of it?
Because they are themselves, they declare that they are themselves the police of the world. They are above any kind of law. I mean, the U.S. is currently having war, illegal war. When I say illegal, I don't mean on an international level. I say illegal within the laws of the United States of America. They are engaged in 7 illegal wars that they have never taken as military. They did not take the permission of their own Congress for it to be involved in it, so they don't even abide by their own laws, not only by international law. So we're talking about an actual entity that is spreading terrorism, that brings benefit, that brings resources, and that brings more money and more hegemony to that entity that's residing in Washington, D.C. This is something that we only read about in history, like the likes of Rome or certain, for example, kingdoms in the East that were taking over swaths of land and being hegemonic against its people and stealing its resources and taking taxes from the people. This is exactly what we read throughout history, but it's with technology, it's with drones, it's with military capability, and it's with hegemonic power in diplomacy as well, where they always find some sort of a window to justify or give themselves the right to operate the way they do. I mean, even if it was in a battlefield, I would have at least respected an enemy that fights back in the battlefield. But Hash Qasem Soleimani was on a diplomatic visit to Iraq. He was having a political situation that he was dealing with in Iraq. It was not a military visit, because we all knew Hash Qasem Soleimani. When he wanted to be on the ground militarily, he would cross from Syria to Iraq from the borders, which the Mujahideen liberated. He wouldn't have taken the airplane to begin with. But the Americans, along with the Mossad, because Israel played a big part in this assassination, they were very keen on killing the man. And it happened that Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the comrade and the longtime friend of Qasem Soleimani, was there to receive them at the airport, that two of the greatest commanders in our region were taken out in one blow. But when the United States of America tries to give out a justification, no one in the world, even their own allies, believe that this justification is legalized or legitimate or actually has any sense. They just play police, but at the, right. the real time, they are gangsters. It's a big institution that has big guns, big money, that tries to take control of other nations. This is what the United States of America is.
Well, if they have big guns and they have big machinery in the military arena, Donald Trump is missing something else, because it came out later that Trump had said and confessed that he's afraid. He's afraid that there's going to be a retaliation and that Iran would try to assassinate him. That's how scared he was. Especially at an event, he said he has to fly back to Washington where he could be safer. And two of the other things that he said, which I found interesting to ask you, Daniel Yajich, is first, he said Soleimani was plotting an imminent and sinister attack on American diplomats. We covered that. But we caught him in the act. I find that to be interesting. And terminated him. And then he said that if he hadn't done that, that there would be a war between the United States and Iran. Those two statements are kind of odd, aren't they?
Yes, they are. But also, I don't think we should be expecting any logic or reasoning behind justifications that the United States administration has been providing for its extraterritorial violence and killing of people in Western Asia and beyond. And I think if we look at these particular statements that you just outlined, they're also representative of this very broad political communications that the U.S. administration has been using for decades now, where people are identified as threats, as so-called terrorists, although there isn't even a proper definition of what that term should or could entail. So there's a very particular language that is being used to dehumanize people and to convert them rhetorically into threats that could be eliminated in order to create consent for the killing. And I think, it is very similar to the justifications that are being used on a daily basis for the killings of individual Palestinians. If we want to look at another context where any sort of colonial or imperial violence is justified as being some sort of self-defense or some sort of an act that would prevent further violence against the United States. So this entire rhetoric is very much just trying to find a reasoning and, again, to add all of these Orientalist and Islamophobic narratives that there already are to their own audience in order to justify those killings. But also beyond that, I think we should also just ask the question why there is even this discourse that is being led by the United States in which they are justifying their invasions and their illegal incursions into Iran, Iraq, and other places Indeed. In Western Asia to begin with, because the entire discourse is, again, based on some sort of justification that there is a reason why the United States should be involved or should be present militarily in Western Asia to begin with. Yeah, so to come back to the question, I think it is just rhetorically, those were just, again, attempts to justify this very form of, we could call it state terrorism that has been conducted.
You know, I'm really perplexed here, and maybe you could help me out, Marwa Usman, when we take a look at the real reasons when it comes down to why Trump ordered the assassination, even though some say Mike Pompeo actually convinced him to do so, whether the intel on this was correct or whether they really saw Hajj Qasem Soleimani as the figure that stood in the way for the U.S. to execute different types of operations on the ground, whether it be in Iraq or whether it be in Syria or West Asia as a whole. So they saw him as a stumbling block, because they obviously didn't understand the relationship between Hajj Qasem Soleimani representing Iran and Iraq. When we're talking about deep cultural and religious links that exist between the two countries, and what exists in Iraq in terms of whatever it was that he was doing, which was eradicating the terrorists, some which have been supported by the U.S., then that was in the way, he stood in the way. Isn't that the real reason, perhaps, for the choice that was made to assassinate him?
Definitely. Kaveh, when you look at the timeline of liberating Syria and Iraq, especially the bordering area between Syria and Iraq from Daesh, what's known in the West as ISIS, you see that the timeline led to a fast track to the assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani, because from late 2017, basically on the New Year's Eve of 2017, up until late 2019, it was fast tracking of liberating areas that were controlled by ISIS, especially areas that are vital for the resistance to move from Iraq to Syria to defend both border lines. And the next step for Iraq in specific was to try and liberate areas in Anbar. And these areas, just like in Syria, the eastern part of the Euphrates, you have the western part of Anbar, where basically the United States of America resides and has military bases there. We see that ISIS only operates there, which has a lot of question mark for the people who don't understand how the U.S. actually aids and trains and funds the likes of ISIS, terrorist organizations like ISIS, to create havoc in the region. But it was this area which was the next plan for Haj Qasem Soleimani and the resistance, the Hashd al-Shaabi, the PMU in Iraq, and the Syrian Arab Army and the affiliates, the national forces as well in Syria, to try to take over these lands and as well, and to liberate the area, specifically the area where the real heavy resources for both countries are placed. So that was poking a hole in the plan of the United States of America, which is why up until now we saw that these pockets that are occupied and inhabited by U.S. occupation forces are still open for Daesh roaming, and they are the most vital for Syria, for example, and the Umar oil field or the Konik oil field, where if these oil fields are liberated, the economic sanctions against Syria would have no valid critical effect on the people, which is why this was the next phase, the next step, to try to liberate the people economically by giving them their resources back. And that was a big no-no for the empire and its puppet regime here in West Asia, which is the Zionist regime. And they decided to take that plan and make it happen, but they don't really understand that when we lose commanders, we become more motivated ideologically, religiously, and at a national level to move forward, to take that ideology, to learn what we were educated by these commanders and put it on a new level of resistance. That's what they don't understand. Basically, if they really understood how the revolution in Iran worked and how it's still renewing itself year after year, if they actually understood that, they wouldn't attempt a regime change right now, which failed from week one. They don't understand the ideology, they don't understand the culture, and basically that's our superpower in the resistance.
This fact is really important. It kind of relates back to that question I asked you, Daniel Yejic, when it came to Iran's leader, saying that the resistance is now somewhat like a shot in the arm after that assassination took place. Are we looking at U.S. mishaps and failures as something that they don't learn from? Because that is something that keeps repeating itself. And I'm wondering, to what degree is the U.S. Why it is that they continue down a wrong path when it comes to, well, in this case, since we're talking about Qasem Soleimani, about Iran overall, because they're exerting such pressure that is not helping. And in the case of the assassination, well, Iraq came out, I forget what duration of time, where the lawmakers voted to have the U.S. troops out of the country, to be told to leave the country. These are all foreign policy failures. Why does the U.S. continue down this wrong path?
Yeah, I think that it absolutely misunderstands and continues, despite the presence of the U.S. military in the region for so many decades, and despite Western Asia being a very central not only to U.S. foreign policy, but also to U.S. political identity and its role in the world and its presentation to itself, it still continues to fail to misunderstand the dynamics in the region, but also the fact that there are dynamics such as solidarity and resistance among the people that are based, as Marwa already said, on ideologies and on learning and advancing. Also going back to the example that was mentioned, the Iranian Revolution, because on the other side, the United States has, with its allies and proxies in the region, more of a transactional relationship where the Zionist entity serves as some sort of military base and European proxy colony that is used to develop weapons to oppress indigenous people, and where other regimes have relations with the United States that are based on favors, are based on economic favors and on political violence, whereas we look at a perspective of the resistance, there is a very broad resistance of people in the region, liberating themselves, having lived under different forms of occupation, colonization, terrorism, and in fact, sanctions, and having a very human reactions to that. And I think that the United States continues to misunderstand this, thinking that it could, through its pressure and through economic sanctions and to, through other forms of state violence, continue to oppress people and subjugate them into changing their ideologies, which obviously is not possible. And I think this will continue to be a major failure for the United States, and shows again the strength of the resistance that will eventually obviously prevail and lead to the liberation of Western Asia.
All right. The idea of revenge has been discussed a lot, Marwa Osman, trying to overpower the real importance of Haj Qasem Soleimani and what he meant overall. They're trying to, the Western media in particular, obviously they're trying to somewhat have that be the overarching theme, that you see Iran now wants to take revenge and trying to demonize Iran in that respect. Now, I'm not here to promote revenge, nor am I a spokesperson for the foreign policy of Iran. But my question somewhat parallels the notion where there has to be something that stops the U.S. from doing this again. Because we had the U.N. report, we've had the condemnations, but the U.S. still will have that kind of an option on its radar because we see its allies doing it, like Israel. So what path can be taken in order to prevent the U.S. and its allies overall to not think that ordering an assassination is okay? Since, well, the U.S. has done it, Israel has been doing it, therefore it's okay to do that.
Well, I think that with the initial retaliation that happened on Ain al-Assad Air Base that killed more than 120 U.S. soldiers, if they don't know, we know how to count. We know how to count. We monitor how they announce the fatalities of their own soldiers because they are so afraid to announce that strike actually led to the killing of 120. But over the course of 3 months, we were able to count the casualties that were reported by the U.S. Army, be it by calling it friendly fire or in action. But we understand, we saw the immense power that fell on that military base. And I think that was the initial phase of retaliation, which was the direct military phase of retaliation. But retaliation has been going on since the first day of the assassination with the motivation to keep the struggle going, to keep the resistance alive. And we've seen how on several fronts, the Americans are practically suffering certain losses that they have did not plan to suffer, or they did not think they would be able to suffer, whether be it in the their colony, in the Zionist entity. We did see at several levels, for example, the Al-Quds, the sort of Al-Quds operation in 2020 and 2021. We also saw several retaliation in Syria. We saw how Yemen was steadfast and actually won more land. So it's more of a collective effort at the level of the resistance axis by taking the knowledge and the wisdom of Haj Qasem Soleimani and moving forward with it. Now, the next phase obviously would be to try and disengage the hegemony of the United States of America from the economic crisis that hit the region because of their sanctions, because of their policies that try to suffocate the people now, not to target the military as much as to target the people in order to make the people rise against the resistance. They failed at an ideological level, but I think that the resistance, the new phase that the resistance has entered, which is basically not only a military alliance, but also an economic alliance in the region, will be the next phase of the struggle, the next phase of resistance.
Sure.
And I think it's just a cumulative factor of resistance, which is how we retaliate for this SS.
Thank you for that, indeed. Marwa Osman, journalist and political analyst, a pleasure from Beirut. Daniel Yedish, it's great to see you, author and researcher from Barcelona. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahoe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the Islamic lifestyle, and that being performance of salah. When it comes to nurturing salah in the lives of our children, we find that salah, on one hand, is a very important part of the Islamic identity. And on the other hand, we find that salah needs to be nurtured in a gradual process, in a timely manner, such that the children are gradually introduced to salah from the beginning of their lives till the time they become baligh, or they reach their age of maturity, when salah actually becomes an obligation on them. The question that arises here is, who is the best person to lead this process of nurturing salah? When we look at the Holy Quran and when we look at the Islamic traditions, we find that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has placed this important and exceptional responsibility of nurturing His worship on the shoulders of the parents themselves. We find a verse of the Holy Quran that openly and clearly tells the parents and says, وَأْمُرْ أَهْلَكَ بِالصَّلَاةِ وَاسْطَبِرْ عَلَيْهَا. When this verse was revealed to the Holy Prophet, which means that enjoin your family towards salah, and you yourself be patient and perseverant with it. Indeed, this was revealed to the Holy Prophet, and the first and the best person to act on it as a role model was the Holy Prophet himself. When this verse was revealed, he would go to the door of his daughter's house, Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullahi alayha, every day, and he would knock and remind them to perform salah. Obviously, it was a family that was already very keen on performing salah, but as the order from Allah came that enjoin salah on your family, he would do that, and he would encourage all Muslims to do so when it came to their own families. And he also himself would be patiently and perseverantly keeping his salah front and center. So on one hand, we find that the responsibility lies with the parents, that they begin the process, they manage the process, they guide the process of nurturing salah in the lives of their children. Since they're the ones who are constantly attached to the children, they're constantly available as well, and they have more resources at hand than any other human being to introduce salah and to enjoin it to the children. We find this to be a very important aspect, especially as parents, that when we perform salah ourselves and we pay attention, it lays the seeds in the hearts and minds of the children that an important part of a Muslim's life is to perform salah. Once this is established, the children themselves begin to value salah, and they themselves wish to be at the forefront of performance of salah. Obviously, at times we need to keep in mind that teaching and inculcation of salah needs to be done gradually and without pressure and excess. and keeping in mind the capacities of the children front and center, so that the children do not get, on one hand, driven away or bored from Salah. Indeed, as parents, it's a very important responsibility that we need to take on our shoulders. It is a Quranic injunction. At the same time, it is the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The recent upsurge in terrorist attacks on security forces as well as citizens across Pakistan has forced Pakistan's civilian and military leadership to join their hands to stop the ongoing violence. The country's National Security Committee, a body of top civil and military leaders, has met for a second time in less than a week in Islamabad and agreed to take stern actions against those trying to sabotage the peace and stability of the country. The committee announced that no country will be allowed to provide a safe haven for the terrorists, and Pakistan reserves the right to take measures to protect its people. Pakistani lawmakers support the decision taken by the committee, saying terrorists should be dealt with full force.
Country's economic situation is worsening day by day due to the militants' activities. These terrorists are enemies of Pakistan. The entire nation is united against terrorism. Those who challenge Pakistan will get a strong response.
Analysts say that the country has witnessed a record 50% increase in terrorist attacks last year following the return of Afghanistan's Taliban to power.
This is really a source of great worry for Pakistan and the security forces of Pakistan. Pakistan was expecting that after the Taliban takeover in Kabul, the terrorism will go down and this tide of terrorism will subside. But that has not happened, unfortunately.
Pakistan is facing a resurgence of violent attacks in recent months. Most of the attacks have so far been claimed by Tehrik-e-Taliban, an armed group also known as Pakistani Taliban, due to its ideological affiliation with the Afghan Taliban.
Besides saving the fragile economy of Pakistan, experts believe the government has to devise a comprehensive strategy to counter the security threats as the country is heading into an election year. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
North Korea and South Korea both rang in the new year with missiles. North Korea launched several ballistic missiles over the weekend, with leader Kim Jong-un unveiling a new shorter-range design to carry tactical nuclear weapons. South Korea unannounced Friday launched a solid-fuel rocket it says is designed to place a spy satellite in orbit. North Korea launched a record number of missiles in 2022, more than 90. This comes as South Korea inaugurated a new leader in May. President Yoon Suk-yeol has implemented a hard line against Pyongyang, including strengthening the country's alliance with the United States. South Korea's President Yoon also restarted large-scale joint military exercises with the United States, with plans to conduct 20 live-fire drills this year. Some South Koreans believe more live-field exercises are necessary.
The South Korea-U.S. joint training is a must. Even when I was in the military, I did that joint training with the U.S., but the computer-simulated war games were not effective at all. There needs to be more active, live and practical training.
Other South Korean people want negotiations.
Before increasing or even maintaining defense spending, I think it's important to have a conversation. Since the problem with North Korea is so emotional, because we are a divided country separated by war.
At a party meeting last week, the North's Kim promised to increase Pyongyang's nuclear deterrent in the coming year. While in South Korea in 2022, the U.S. lifted restrictions on Seoul's missile range and payload and established an American Space Command to better surveil the region. Frank Smith, Press, Seoul.
Tehran has hosted a conference titled General Qasem Soleimani and the New World Order. Senior military and state officials attended the conference to discuss the role of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in the fight against terrorism and in the creation of a new world order. Addressing the conference, Major General Yahya Rahim Safavi, the top military advisor to leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the U.S. has made many mistakes during the past decades, one of the gravest of which was the assassination of General Soleimani in January 2020.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani triggered the creation of a new world order by the resistance front in the face of arrogant powers. The axis of arrogance led by the U.S. is projecting power through militaristic approaches as well as hybrid and media warfare, while the resistance front, spearheaded by Iran and Ayatollah Khamenei, has adopted the cultural influence strategy by using soft power and standing up to the arrogant axis.
General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC. The United States assassinated him along with Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, and their companions in a drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020.
General Qasem Soleimani was active on all fronts for nearly 30 years without interruption and without hesitation. His personality was outstanding not only in terms of decimating Daesh in Syria and Iraq, but also in sending out positive vibes and displaying courage to everyone. He was a symbol of international resistance who redefined the rules of leadership.
General Soleimani is well known for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq back in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from Daesh control. Observers say by assassinating General Soleimani, the U.S. tried to resurrect the terrorists. However, they call it a miscalculation which backfired on Washington, triggering the beginning of its exit from the region.
Although the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani put an end to his life, his legacy will continue forever, and he will remain as a role model for all resistance and anti-terrorism Karens. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Ah,
Afghan people from different walks of life have gathered at Iran's cultural center to mark the third assassination anniversary of anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani. Participants expressed sympathy with the Iranian nation, saying that General Soleimani was a hero for the entire region.
The pain and grief of the loss of the great martyr Soleimani does not only belong to Iranians. Sardar Soleimani is the hero and flag bearer of the fight against terrorism in the region. He played a very significant and decisive role in our world.
It's the duty of the Muslim world to call for justice for General Soleimani. This huge crime, the killing of a Muslim Iranian general by the U.S., should be investigated by the U.N. Commander Soleimani was targeted by the U.S. when he was busy fighting international terrorism and U.N.-designated terrorist groups.
Participants also say that Commander Soleimani played a key role in the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group in West Asia and in the fight against international criminals.
Commander Soleimani, as a commander of Islam, was there for Muslims everywhere. He was active and supported oppressed people in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Likewise, he was involved in a fight against the arrogance in Afghanistan, too. He trained and directed Afghans to defend their soil against invaders and maintain their freedom. Commander Soleimani fought in a campaign for the freedom of Muslim Ummah.
Along with other admirers of General Soleimani, Afghans every year commemorate the legacy and life of the anti-terrorism hero. Afghan people have long been fighting for their freedom. They remember General Soleimani as a leader and a role model for them and for all freedom seekers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Iranian army's radars have spotted a hostile UAV flying 25,000 feet above its southern waters. Its mission was to strike sensitive Iranian military facilities. The army quickly operated its homegrown Talosh missile system, and this is what happened to the intruding drone. This scenario was part of the last phase of a large-scale military drill held over an area stretching from the Strait of Hormuz all the way to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The drills cover a 3 million square kilometer area. They aim to test the preparedness of our young personnel and our military equipment that have recently been added to our fleet. Our military might send the message of peace and friendship to our neighbors, but to our enemies, it's a show of power and deterrence.
The three-day maneuvers saw the deployment of several pieces of domestically built equipment, from drones and missile systems to warships, submarines, and tanks. The country has been building up its defense arsenal against the backdrop of the West's arms embargoes on Tehran. The army says today it is capable of protecting the country's land, air, and sea borders using locally developed hardware.
All of the systems used in these maneuvers have been developed domestically. They are designed to hit targets at different altitudes. These exercises show that we, as the Air Defense Force, along with other branches of the Army, are fully capable of defending our country using military technologies that have been fully developed domestically.
The Army's Air Defense Force also used its Mersad missile systems to strike hostile air targets. The Army says it's working on more advanced missile systems to further bolster its deterrent power.
Engages all of the four branches of the Iranian army, including its air defense force, which has deployed its latest homegrown missile systems. The army says this is to boost synergy between its different units to be ready to confront any potential threats to its territorial waters. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indictment on the assassination will be announced soon. He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which I never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the prime ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos, which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and the prime ministers just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest. workers taking trade union action and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes, and I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year, a 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
South Korea plans to significantly boost military spending over the next 5 years, an annual increase of nearly 7%. The Eastern Asian country aims to spend over $440 million on anti-drone weapons alone. The announcement comes only days after North Korea flew drones into the South territory for the first time in 5 years.
According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Monday, five North Korean drones crossed the border before breaking formation. Four of them headed to islands in the West Sea, while one of the drones continued south, reaching the skies over the outskirts of this city, the capital, Seoul.
It was the first such incident since 2017 when a drone crossed into South Korea and photographed a U.S. base here. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, a conservative who came to office in May of this year, has blamed the previous progressive government's policy of engaging Pyongyang for the recent incident.
Given that efforts or military training to respond to such UAV drones have never been properly done since 2017, I think our people must have well seen how dangerous a policy relying on the North's good faith and peace agreements would be.
South Korea plans more joint military exercises with the U.S. for 2023, although much of the public wants talks with North Korea and a de-escalation of tensions. Meanwhile, North Korea has unveiled new goals for the country's military. Addressing a large committee meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, leader Kim Jong-un indicated on Wednesday that the country will continue its military development in 2023 after a record year of missile testing. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
اگر ماها نسبت به همسر در خانواده فهم دینی داشته باشیم.
If we have a religious understanding regarding women, family and wife in the house, then we won't go to extremes in today's world. In some parts of the world, there are some men who insult the women and girls and degrade them by captivating them, the same as ignorance period in Arab Peninsula 1400 years ago. Yet, there are some people who claim to free the girls and women by letting them be naked, and they rape them and assault them sexually whenever they wish.
و اسلام با هم افراطش مخالفه و هم با تفریطش.
Islam is against both of these attitudes towards the women. Islam is against degrading of women and giving them absolute freedom or abusing the women. The religion of Islam uses four major words in order to describe the women. Clear understanding about these four words give us a better picture about the position of women in Islam. These words are delicate soul, fine body, chaste spirit, and honorable personality. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Mandegari. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
Nurses at 8 local hospitals in New York City have announced a plan to strike in 10 days. The 10-day notice was announced recently by the New York State Nurses Association. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, an estimated 16,000 unionized nurses from private hospitals across the New York City metropolitan area announced strike authorizations on Friday, December 31st, 2022, as current contracts are set to expire and the region continues to experience a tridemic health crisis that includes COVID-19, flu, and the respiratory illness known as RSV. The New York State Nurses Association, NYSNAA, issued 10-day notices on Friday, December 31st for strikes to begin on January 9th if contract agreements are not reached at 8 hospitals, including New York Presbyterian, Montefiore, Mount Sinai Hospital, Mount Sinai Morningside and West, Maimon Knights, Bronx Care, Richmond University Medical Center, and Flushing Hospital Medical Center. Nurses at each of the hospitals voted separately on whether their union members would go